Okay, we're going to be discussing four of the current leaders in different methodologies, different apologetic methodologies. Now, when you look at three of them, three of these guys are dead, but they did not die a long time ago. I mean, Van Til died in 87, Clark in 85, Schaefer in 84. Guys were still alive and kicking. That's not an indication that he's got the best apologetic methodology out of the four, but I think there are other indications that he has the best apologetic methodology of the four. But what I'm getting at by current is 20th century, I'd say the latter half of the 20th century. So we're talking from 1950 on, and we're talking... Even academic is not a good word, because one of these guys, Schaefer, was really not considered an academic philosopher. He's considered more of a popular one. But we're not going to be dealing with like John Warwick Montgomery, who's an evidentialist. He just goes to history. When we deal with Geisler will touch upon that type of thing. But one thing I want to say, it was an awful lot of work to, I mean, literally, you know, an eight-hour day just to pull together from all that I knew and all that I read from Van Til, Clark, and Schaefer, to pull together their apologetic methodology. You don't read one of their books and tell people that you figured out their apologetic methodology. They never came right out, this is it, period. Although Clark came pretty close in his three types of religious philosophy. But their thought, it's real deep. At the same time, it's scattered throughout their writings. If you could sit these guys down and just talk with them for a couple hours, you'd get some insight into it. But it's really tough when you're going through 15, 20 books that the guys wrote. With Geisler, if anything, probably Geisler a lot of times is not taken real serious in certain academic circles. Not because he isn't a scholar, but I think because he simplifies his material to such a degree that it no longer seems profound, yet it is. Geisler, I just went through his Christian apologetics. His apologetic methodology is right there in that book. Now, it doesn't mean that he's not a profound thinker. It took me three or four times of reading that book before I figured out what he was saying. But once I figured it out, I saw that he had it. He basically did all the thinking for you and just laid it out step by step. So it took me 8 hours for each of these guys. You know, most of these guys, well, Van Til, I've only read two of his books, but I've listened to numerous lectures on him. Clark, I've read about 17, 18 of his books. Schaefer, I've read about the same amount of his books. Geisler, I've read probably over 20 of his books. But with Geisler, just one book gives you his apologetic methodology step by step by step. So keep in mind, if it looks like I'm shooting off the hip with some of these other guys, it's because I am. And that's kind of the way they portrayed it. So we have to take it for what it's worth. Now, if I have to say anything, the guy who's going to make the biggest impact and has made the biggest impact out of these four is Schaefer. His philosophy does not sound like he's lecturing you in a classroom. Geisler, it sounds more like classroom lectures than anybody else. But Schaefer, it sounds like you're sitting down. You're both sitting down in rocking chairs with a bare rug on the floor, and there's a fire going, and you're both puffing on pipes, talking philosophy and having an intellectual discussion. And I think because of that, I don't like when guys like Tom Morris from Notre Dame take everything. If Schaefer says that Christianity alone explains this, I don't think that Schaefer would say... take that literally. In other words, that there's times when he says something to get... there's times when he overemphasizes a point, but it's just dialogue. In fact, most of Schaefer's books were lectures that he gave, and publishing companies typed them up and asked him, can we publish them, and you'll get the royalties. And he said, okay, but let me look them over. And what a guy just tends to say in a lecture, a lot of times, as soon as the words are out of your mouth, you wish you had them back. So I don't think although Schaefer was not an academic philosopher like Clark or Geisler, and he did get a lot of his misconceptions from Van Til. He was a student of Van Til. We'll get to that. Now look at the top of each of these handouts. Yeah?
I'd like you to define informal philosophy as
opposed to an analysis. You could probably call him that. I would just say an academic philosopher as opposed to... not an armchair philosopher. That's a real slam. An academic philosopher, as opposed to self-taught, but also I like the word a creative philosopher. See, I see Schaefer as the closest thing to a Jean-Paul Sartre that we have. Here, Sartre was, and he was writing plays and novels. Well, Schaefer wasn't writing plays and novels, but his books were as exciting as plays and novels. And so I think Schaefer's got more of an impact. It's more creative, but in that creativity, it's just like the Old Testament was very poetic. But if you take it literal, then it sounds like God has arms. So you don't get that academic splitting of hairs that you would like to see in the academic setting. But there are times that Schaefer does tend to misrepresent people like Thomas Aquinas, or even at times Rene Descartes, but not so much Descartes as Aquinas. I think the two people like Geisler at times, they were a little jealous of him. He had such a so much of a bigger name than guys like Geisler and Moreland and Craig. At the same time, he was nowhere near the philosopher that they were academically. In fact, but see, Schaefer only considered himself an evangelist. That's all he said. You know, all these guys are slamming me for not being an academic philosopher. I'm not. All these guys slamming me and say they don't like my method of apologetics. I'm really not an apologist. I just think that if you're going to witness to man, modern man, what I would call postmodern man, if you're going to witness to modern man and evangelize him, you need to do some pre-evangelism first. You need to start where he's at and then basically break down his straw house and then show them that only the house of Christianity can stand. So I don't see it as a slam. Moreland agrees with me. Moreland loves Schaefer stuff. But if you ask Moreland who's a better academic philosopher, you or Schaefer, he'd tell you Schaefer was an MDiv degree. He was basically trained to be a pastor who self-taught. He taught himself through the study of scriptures and the study of philosophy. And then received an honorary doctorate from Simon Greenleaf School of Law. Van Til now is a trained theologian, but he was trained at Princeton, where you had a lot of idealistic philosophers that were teaching there. And I don't want to get too much into that, but Clark and Geisler were as academic as you can get in that they had their PhDs were in philosophy, and their profession was they were professors of philosophy. And the only times like you'll find Geisler being a professor of something else is if they don't have a philosophy department. But basically, he taught apologetics and philosophy. Sometimes he taught systematic theology, whatever. But for the most part, they are professional philosophers from beginning to end. I would not say that Schaefer was not an academic philosopher as a slam on him, but just as a statement of a fact. But he has more of a creative. Probably the closest to him right now is R.C. Sproul. I believe his doctorate degree, and according to Bonson, this is the case, that his doctorate degree was honorary as well. And so he's just as your basic Master of Divinity or Master of Theology transfer. He's a theologian without a doctorate who's done his homework and has taught himself a lot about philosophy, plus the schools that he went to that taught theology taught philosophy as a large part of it. And I think the schools that don't teach philosophy as part of their theology are really not teaching good, solid theology that can be defended in the marketplace of ideas. So schools like Westminster are on the cutting edge in that area, because when they teach you theology, they incorporate everything. What are the main philosophies of the world saying right now, and how do we refute them? Now, whether or not Van Til, when he taught at Westminster, was as solid on the history of philosophy or not. You know, it depends who you're talking to. Anyway, Cornelius Van Til is the first guy we want to talk about. He was born in 1895, died in 1987. Him and Clark both lived good, long lives. The apologetic method, the presuppositionalism, the reason why it's called presuppositionalism is you do not start from square one on neutral ground with the unsaved man and then take one brick at a time, one piece of evidence at a time, and build the case for Christianity. That's traditional apologetics, okay? In presuppositionalism, you presuppose the whole house of Christianity, and then you argue from it, okay? If you presuppose the whole house of Christianity and refuse to argue, you would be a fideist, okay? You would just say that you have to believe by a leap of blind faith. We can't argue about these things, you just got to accept it by a leap of blind faith. But a presuppositionalist will argue in some way for the truth, but it's more of an indirect argumentation. He's already, in other words, he doesn't argue to a conclusion, he argues from his conclusion, which is the presupposition, the Christian presupposition. Usually they presuppose the existence of the triune God who has revealed himself in the scriptures. Something along those lines. Now, that means something different for Gordon Clark than it means for Van Til. Because in Gordon Clark's thinking, God is logic. So that includes the law of non-contradiction. In Van Til's thought, God is above logic, so it doesn't necessarily, it's not part of his presupposition. But we'll get into that. But there's different types of methodologies for presuppositionalism. Van Til, it's called transcendental presuppositionalism. Transcendental presuppositionalism. You will see this on a test. I'm going to try to explain this as we go through Cornelius Van Til, okay? So just hold on to that. Just keep in mind Van Til, transcendental presuppositionalism. Gordon Clark is his type of presuppositionalism is dogmatic presuppositionalism, okay? And Francis Schaeffer, his apologetic methodology was verificational presuppositionalism. And we'll see that each one of these presuppositionalists thinks the other camp is messed up. Okay? So Clark is not only going to slam Geisler, he would slam Schaeffer and Van Til. And Van Til's not only going to slam Geisler, he's going to slam Clark and Schaeffer. Okay? Verificational presuppositionalism. And that's on the top of your page. Now, with Van Til and Gordon Clark, you have the old form, so it's not listed up there. So you want to write that down. Apologetic methodology, Van Til, transcendental presuppositionalism, Clark, dogmatic presuppositionalism, and you already have Schaeffer, verificational presuppositionalism. Now, for Clark, for Geisler, his apologetic methodology is traditional apologetics, i.e. Thomism. He is a Thomist. He argues along the lines of Thomas Aquinas. He's more Thomistic than me, although in the areas where he differs from Aquinas, I would side with him over Aquinas. So I could probably be classified like Dr. Habermas used to call me a Schaefferite because I told him I read almost everything that Schaeffer wrote and I liked Schaeffer. So he said I was a Schaefferite and I said, no, I'm not a Schaefferite. I've read as many, if not more, books by Geisler than on Schaeffer, and I agree more with Geisler. I just thought that Schaeffer had a big contribution to make and had a wider impact. I said, if anything, you probably could call me a Geislerite. So I'm more along Geisler's school of thought than Schaeffer. By the way, if you look on Geisler, what I noted there, and we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but I put a little star up there and I put down that Geisler is one of the few traditional apologists. By the way, I did not do spell check, so if you spot any words I've got like 45 pages and I was trying to do spell check and I just ran out of time. My schedule's been extremely hectic lately, but Geisler is one of the few traditional apologists who has taken some of the presuppositional objections against traditional apologetics to heart. Now, Geisler has not abandoned traditional apologetics, but he has fine-tuned it. And we'll see that when we get to it probably next week. Okay, let's take a look at Cornelius Van Til, his apologetic methodology, which I'll explain as we go through his argumentation, is transcendental presuppositionalism. Okay? His apologetic works, the main two are the Defense of the Faith and Christian Apologetics. Now, the Defense of the Faith, I listed pages 179 to 180 and 298 to 299. That gives you an overview of his whole school of thought there. Okay? Now, some of the handouts on his whole apologetic methodology, some of these things are not coming out clear. Our copy machine's not working real good, so you might want to pen in a few things. He also, his apologetic work is a syllabus of his course, Christian Apologetics. But Christian apologetics, I believe, is contained within the Defense of the Faith. So with Van Til, you save yourself a lot of hassle by just buying the Defense of the Faith. It contains Christian apologetics plus some more, okay? And plus it's got larger print, so it's a little bit more attractive to read. Point number one, and this is the same starting point, really, although Schaefer never made a big issue out of it, and Habermas told me when he lectured at Liberty University, he said that he was willing to use any type of apologetics that works, even traditional apologetics. But for the most part, your presuppositionalists reject traditional apologetics. Yeah, Jeff?
I've got a question about the transcendental part of the presuppositionalism. What essence are they transcending?
Well, we'll get to that. I can answer, it's point number seven, but I can answer it right now. What he wants to do is transcend what we're saying, what we're arguing about, what we're doing, and find out what are the necessary preconditions for our reasoning, for morality. And so it's kind of like the transcendental aspect of Immanuel Kant, the categories and stuff, time, space, all that kind of stuff. In Van Til's sense, what Van Til is arguing is that you have to, just to reason, you have to presuppose the existence of the God of the Bible. Now, I'm not saying he's right, but that's what he's saying. So, and there are some points. I think he can go so far to say that he's correct in that even though people might suppress that truth, deep down inside, you have to presuppose the existence of a personal, intelligent, and moral God, i.e. the God of theism, in order to assume that the world makes sense and we can do things like science, make moral value judgments, and reason. Okay?
It's more like pre-foundational evidence.
Yeah, it's kind of like the foundation for our reasoning processes, the moral judgments we make, and stuff like that. If God does not exist, we would know nothing. If God does not exist, then nothing would exist. But if it's not arguing cosmological argument from the thing that exists to God, it's saying if you don't have God first, there wouldn't even be that there. So it's a different thing. Now, part of my argument against presuppositionalism is no matter which way you're arguing, these guys, presuppositionalists, act like traditional apologists, just use arguments with a high degree of probability. No, you've got to prove God with absolute certainty. Well, I've read Van Til, I've read Clark, and I've read Schaefer, and I can say I do not. All I find is arguments that at times are highly probable, and other times arguments that are highly suspect, but I don't find any certainty. Now, Bronson comes to him the closest to making me lean in that direction because Bronson is real sharp. But we're getting a little bit ahead, but actually we're arguing for the arguing. I saw one mistake there. I left out a G. Bronson would argue in the using transcendental presuppositionalism of Van Til that you're arguing for the impossibility of the contrary. If the God of Christianity does not, it's impossible for us to do what we're doing if the God of Christianity does not exist. And therefore, if the contrary is impossible, then that truth itself is necessary truth. It must be true with certainty. But I don't think he proves his case. So, if anything, he would prove, if he was right, he would prove theism. But I haven't read anything where it would prove the triune God of the Bible. Okay, point number one under Van Til, he rejected traditional apologetics. He rejected the idea that you take one argument, you start with common, with neutral ground. I'm going to differentiate between common ground and neutral ground. Common ground means, Van Til, the way I'm using common ground, Van Til would say, yes, we have common ground with the non-believer. Because we live, whether we deny God's existence, whether we're an atheist or a Christian, we still got to live in God's universe. We have common ground. Okay? However, neutral, a point of neutrality or whatever, what that would be saying is that you can, we can either, the Christian can throw away his biases and the atheist can throw away his biases, and we can start at ground zero and work our way up and argue without biases. Van Til would say, no, that's an impossible. I think both points, I believe, are well taken. But I don't think that the conclusion, therefore, is you need to do his kind of apologetics only. By the way, Van Til, Clark, and Schaefer, I find a lot in them that we can use. And we as traditional apologists can be much better traditional apologists because of it. And by the way, that's what Geisler has done. Geisler has taken them very seriously. But Van Til rejected traditional apologetics that you can't. He would be against, as would Clark, the idea that proving God's existence as the unmoved mover or the uncaused cause of all that exists, he would say, no, God is much more than that. Well, Aquinas would say, yeah, of course God is much more than that. We'll prove that later. Van Til and Clark would see that as like almost idolatry or something, arguing for a false God, not the God of Christianity. But I would disagree, because there's only one cause. He happens also to be all good. He happens also to be infinite, eternal, triune, you know, go right down the line. But he rejected traditional apologetics and said that we've got to presuppose the entire Christian house rather than argue one brick at a time. Now both Van Til and Clark were Calvinists as well as Schaefer, and so they believed that regeneration precedes faith. In other words, I, as more of a Baptist type thinker, I would argue that, and we're not talking in time, we're talking a logical priority, that first you believe in Jesus as your Savior, and then the Holy Spirit makes you born again, regenerates you. Okay? So we freely accept or reject Jesus. God's not going to force us into heaven. But the Calvinists, like Mike McKenzie, Dr. Mike McKenzie is a five-point Calvinist. And Van Til, Clark, and Schaefer, five-point Calvinists, they teach regeneration precedes faith. In other words, God makes a person, totally against their will, God makes a person born again. And then once the person is born again, they freely choose to accept Christ. Okay? Now, I'm going to say it in kind of sloppy terminology, but Calvinism basically teaches that God zaps you. You don't move closer to Christianity and then freely accept Christ. God zaps you. And I think that's where that's why these guys are presuppositionalists. In fact, I would argue that they're more consistent with their Calvinism than R.C. Sproul, Gerstner, and Lindsley, who would do apologetics much like I do. But being a five-point Calvinist, if I was a five-point Calvinist, I wouldn't do apologetics like that. By the way, Calvin was more of a traditional apologist. But the system wasn't as well thought out as it is today. And the implications drawn from, Calvin didn't even have limited atonement, didn't even hold to that. Yeah, Jeff?
The five-point Calvinists, we all hold it for this predestination. I mean, if God makes us go to heaven, he can make us go to heaven.
The double predestination, it depends how you look at it. Does God passively leave them, the unsaved unsaved, the non-elect unsaved? Yes. But does that mean in the Clark sense that he predetermined it to be that way? Or does it mean in more of the Schaefer sense that God just chose to save the elect? So, you know, that all depends. But that'll get probably a little bit off of our subject right now. Point number three, Van Til taught that the Bible is self-authenticating. Now, I think that there's an element of truth to this. Jesus said, I believe it was in John 7, it's either John 5 or John 7, that if you long to do God's will, you'll recognize that the words I am speaking come from God. And I think deep down inside, because God has put His moral law written on our consciences and has revealed His existence to us through nature, I think deep down inside, when we hear the gospel message preached to us, deep down inside, we know it's true. When we read the Bible, deep down inside, we know the Bible is true. But many of us suppress that truth because we don't want to bend the knee to Jesus Christ.
But is that on our own, or is that from the Holy Spirit showing us that this is?
I would say you could answer both yes or no to that, depending on what sense you mean. Because Aquinas made a tremendous wedge, drew a tremendous wedge between faith and reason. And Aquinas would say, yeah, the natural man would know certain things and through nature and blah, blah, without any help from God. Augustine would say, hey, you really can't, even natural revelation is what God is revealing. So the way God made us, so in other words, even if we did something because of our basic nature, even if we arrived at something new of God's existence because of our basic nature, it's still in essence a work of God. But with Augustine, that division is blurred. And God is even at work, even for Phil Fanatis to recognize this desk, God is turning on the light. Jesus Christ is the light which enlightens every man. In Aquinas, no, God just created our minds in such a way that they can draw rational conclusions from sense data, but it's all a natural process. But still, even there, you could say, yeah, it's a natural process that God set in motion. So, you know, either way, God gets the glory, God gets the credit, whether He set something in motion or whether He's actively involved. Yeah.
I don't see that as the Bible being self-authenticating. Even if I do have an encounter with the Bible and I have my counsel to agree with it, that's not the validation doing good. It's the validation of the Bible.
I would argue along these lines. I would concede this point to Van Til in that I would take a Pascalian position that the heart has its reasons, which reason knows nothing about. In other words, we know that we know that we know that we know some things that we can't prove rationally. And so rational certainty, I don't think we can argue to God's existence with rational certainty, but I think there are other types of certainty. For the Moreland points out, there's certain things that we know, but we can't prove it with rational necessity. For instance, the illustration Moreland gives in Scaling the Secular City, we all know that every sane person knows that torturing innocent babies is wrong. Now try to prove that through reason alone, with rational necessity, so that the opposite is contradictory. Can't be done. So I think that God has set us up in such a way, it's like Augustine said, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. He said that real early in his Confessions. There's a void in our heart that can only be filled by God. At the same time, there's a drive for human autonomy, a drive to be our own kings. And we have to decide whether we're going to come off the throne and allow God to fill that void. Well, I think when an unsaved man picks up that Bible, he feels like that void is beginning to be filled, but he rebels against that and suppresses that truth. That's like the Bible said that man knows God's existence through nature, Romans 1, 18 to 22, but he suppresses that truth. And I believe he suppresses that truth so well. Bonson wrote his dissertation on self-deception. I believe man lies to himself so well that if an atheist took a lie detector test and you asked him, do you believe that God exists, and he answers no, I believe he would pass that lie detector test. But I believe he's taken that truth and he suppressed it. And I believe that we deceive ourselves. We're experts at deceiving ourselves so that we deceive ourselves better than we deceive others. You know, we can always justify our actions when everybody else around knows, you know, Fernandez, you blew it. Don't make excuses. You just straight out blew it. And Fernandez can come up with 15 reasons why it wasn't my fault, it was the other guy's fault. You know, he had it coming. And his face was right there within range, punching range. And but let's take a look at point number four. Apologetics must start, this is according to Van Til, must start with the presupposition that the triune God exists and has authoritatively revealed himself in Scripture. Okay? Beats me, and I don't think there were too many saved Jews. There might not have been any saved Jews who figured out the doctrine of the Trinity before Jesus came on the scene. How did they do their apologetics? I mean, they couldn't presuppose the triune God if they didn't even know triune God, that God was triune. But he says that we have to start with that presupposition. By the way, I think if you start with that presupposition, you can still develop a good, solid apologetic system. What I disagree with Van Til is I don't think you have to start with that. I think you could start, if a guy will debate you, he has to presuppose what Aquinas calls the first principles of knowledge. And from the first principles of knowledge, the atheist has given you enough rope to hang him with. And so I don't think you need to presuppose what Van Til says here. Point five, all non-Christian reasoning presupposes human autonomy. This is where he's talking about a non-Christian who hasn't trusted. Keep in mind the difference between Christianity and non-Christian belief systems is viewed a little bit differently than we view it if we're not five-point Calvinists. His whole view of salvation is everything was done, even your believing was basically done by God. And so, even to a certain degree, we Baptists are too much into human autonomy. Okay? We're inconsistent Christians. At least Van Til will give us that we're Christians. Okay? Keep in mind what he's saying is that this atheist is saying, I don't believe God exists, but I can reason anyway. The universe got here by chance, but I can make sense of it all anyway. There is no moral lawgiver, but I know right from wrong anyway. Okay, he's assuming that he is the king. He's basically replacing God. And there's an element of truth to this. Modern science got started because a bunch of Bible-believing Christians recognized that a reasonable God designed the universe in a reasonable way so that through reason man could find out about the elements, the relationship between the elements of the universe. Modern science probably would not have started in an atheistic... Well, in fact, atheism has not advanced science at all. If anything, atheism has set science back. I was going to recommend a book. I can't remember the title of it right now.
Non-Christian scientific flourishing would have been the Arabs or the Muslims, like where they believe in Allah,
theism. Well, even there, though, you can pretty much argue that when you talk about theism, you're talking about Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Judaism is what? It is apostate Christianity. The non-Christian cults are apostate Christianity. The Islamic faith is apostate Christianity. So, in the elements that those guys are hitting the nail right on the head, it's basically what they've got from the old, what they haven't perverted from the old Christian system, and that's the idea of a personal God and all. Point number six. Van Til argues that all reasoning is circular. Now, let me say, in philosophy, they teach you that circular reasoning is an invalid way to argue. For instance, if we argue miracles violate the law, wait, the laws of nature cannot be violated. Miracles are violations of the laws of nature. Therefore, miracles are impossible. That sounds real good, but the problem is, premise number one is the conclusion. The way we define miracles, premise number one and the conclusion are identical. We just dress them up in different terms. Because once you recognize that when this guy says that what he means by a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and his first premise is that the laws of nature cannot be... In other words, his premise, first premise is miracles are impossible. Premise number two, and then conclusion. Therefore, miracles are impossible. Okay? Now, in one sense, I'm thinking, Van Til, you're crazy. How can you say all reasoning is circular? But then in another sense, there is an element of truth in it, and that is that what he's basically saying, we argue from our conclusions, not to them. Okay?
I was going to ask a question about our argument. If your first premise is true, then your conclusion is true, but wouldn't that still be a form of circular argument? Could it be used?
Well, if the conclusion flows from the first conclusion, the first premise in a deductive argument, if it follows, then you've got a valid argument. But the problem is, if you're even if you're using a deductive argument, if your first premise is the same exact thing as your conclusion, then you've argued in a circle. Now the conclusion is still going to be true if the first premise is true. But then that's where we would question. Where's this idea that the laws of nature cannot be violated? Because the laws of nature are basically are not prescriptive. They don't prescribe what can and cannot happen. They're descriptive of what usually happens. And a miracle is what happens extremely not frequently because it's divine intervention. But there are also other natural events that are very infrequent. You know, there haven't been two Napoleon Bonapartes. There was only one, a very unique guy. So if we're going to say the only events that can occur are regular, natural events, then by definition, miracles can't exist. But we can question the truth of that premise. So what he's saying, what he's basically saying is, atheists start with their first premise. It might be hidden, but their first premise really is that there is no God, and then they argue from there. The Christian's first premise is the God of the Bible does exist, and then they argue from there. Now, I think that to a certain degree, even traditional apologists have to admit that we are not like Rene Descartes, and Rene Descartes is not even like Rene Descartes. We have not thrown out all of our beliefs. And by the way, Descartes never claimed that he really gave up all his beliefs. He just claimed it's like innocent until proven guilty. Doesn't mean you have to believe O.J. Simpson is innocent. It means you give him the benefit of the doubt. Okay? And so Descartes was saying, as a method, I'm not going to hold to philosophically any of my beliefs, even though I might hold to them religiously, until I find something, I'm going to doubt everything until I can find something I can't doubt anymore. But basically, we don't start with a blank slate and then build a case. In actuality, we have to admit, when I debated Dr. Peter John, I was a biased Christian, and he was a biased atheist. But the question comes up, whose biases or presuppositions are correct? And I think they can both be tested. And to a certain degree, to be honest with you, because they're not fideist, at least not consistent in their fideist, and they've attempted not to be fideist, Van Til, Clark, and Schaefer are acting like their presuppositions can be tested. So let's just do what Geisler did, refine our traditional apologetics, but do your basic traditional apologetics. I don't think, as Geisler says, old Aquinas should not be forgotten. But basically, there is a certain amount of truth to that, that we are not really coming into our debates without any biases at all. We are biased towards Christianity. The unsaved is But let's just get further in his thought, and a lot of these things will be explained. Now, point number seven, Van Til held to the transcendental argument. By transcendental, what he meant was the necessary conditions for human knowledge. In other words, the necessary conditions that transcend our argumentation, transcend the things of everyday life. There's something that is underneath that, the foundation of it, if you will. Okay, the necessary conditions for human knowledge is what he means by transcendental. What he would argue with the transcendental argument is that all human thought and moral judgments would be impossible if Christianity is not true. Van Til, here's a couple quotes from Van Til. If God does not exist, we know nothing. Okay? Even Rene Descartes brought up, what if instead of God, what exists is a deceiving demon and he makes truths look false to us and falsehoods look true to us? Well, there's really no way to disprove that. Maybe this deceiving demon even deceives us about the law of non-contradiction. The fact is, we've all woken up from a dream or sweating thinking that somebody was trying to murder us, and then we found out it was only a dream, but we really believed it was real. Maybe we're going to wake up and find out that what we thought was the real world was just a dream, and we actually exist in a world where people are 35 feet tall. And then we might wake up and find out, well, that's a dream. Just to assume that we really know this desk and that we're not being deceived, Van Til has a point there. We have to assume that a good God exists who isn't deceiving us. Okay? And by the way, it's impossible for us to live any other way. If we're going to assume that we're always being deceived, instead of drinking water, we're going to drink strychnine. And then our friends will be attending our funerals. Yeah, yeah.
This is basically just being theologically or doing your theology backwards from God to person instead of from person to God.
Yeah, and exactly. You hit the nail right on the head. It's actually doing your apologetics backwards from our standpoint. But here's what Van Til will say, and I think he's wrong. Van Til will say to start with man and then to argue to God is idolatry. We need to start with God. And I think that on that point, Sproul, Lindsley, and Gerstner were correct that reason is logically prior to faith, but it's not more. In other words, we reason to God, but that doesn't mean. If we reason to God, it's prior to it in time. You have to start with where you are. You have to start with your own mind and then reason to God. It's not saying that your mind comes first chronologically and logically. Your mind doesn't come first in importance. So we're not saying that you start with man because man's more important than God. It's just you start with man because that's who you are, man. You start on earth because you're on earth. And you argue up to heaven. And these guys to say, no, you got to start in heaven, anything else is idolatry, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact they believe that regeneration precedes faith. They're Calvinists, and God's after you. So in other words, all you have is human autonomy, and you will stay there until God makes you born again without you even desiring it, and then you freely choose Christ.
Yeah, well, Jesus, in the Bible, when Jesus was on earth, didn't he argue from man to God? In the parables and everything that he told, didn't he start with man and to work his way up to God?
Not really. I would think that Paul was arguing from man to God in Romans 1. Jesus was talking to an audience, whether Jew or Gentile, and it was mostly Jewish, the audience that he spoke to, that already accepted God's existence. So he wasn't really arguing to God. That's why I say when he said theologically and I changed it to apologetically there. But if God does not exist, we know nothing. If God is kind of a guarantee that we're not being deceived. Okay. Van Til also said self-consciousness presupposes God-consciousness. See, we're created in God's image. Just to be conscious of ourselves means deep down inside, whether we admit it or not, we're conscious of God. I think there's a truth to that. I don't think Van Til ever proved it. And Van Til would say, I didn't prove it. I presupposed it. But the contrary is impossible. Well, I don't think he proved the contrary was impossible, but unless he was just arguing for theism, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, Van Til also said, arguing about the existence of air is similar to arguing about the existence of God. In other words, you can argue that air does not exist, but one needs air in order to argue against the existence of air. So you're arguing against the existence of air, but you're breathing in air all the time. Well, and Van Til says it's the same thing. When you're arguing against God's existence, you're depending on His existence just to reason throughout the whole process. Okay? Yeah. Self-refuting and all. And I think there is truth here, but it's truth that is being presupposed. It's not truth that is being proven. And if it's not being proven, we're really not doing apologetics. Okay? Now, later on, he moves to other steps, but that's his transcendental argument. That's supposed to be his argument. So, I think there's some strengths to it, but there's also some weaknesses as well. Van Til, and there's a lot of Van Til. Dr. Mike made a statement that disagreed with me on this, and I didn't argue with him, but his own professor, John Frame, agrees with me, and Greg Bonson, another student. They're the two leading Van Tilians alive. They agree with me. Romans 1, 18-22, where God reveals Himself to man in nature. This is an important point, so I'm going to have to skip over to the next slide.